Good evening, Chanukah Sameach. Wow, I am blown away. But it is quite windy, so that would explain that. Good to see all of you.
Regards from Michael Messing.
Thank you. Thank you very much. The entire world will now hear those regards. We did a lot of work last time, and we have even more work to do this evening. And apologies, we're a little behind schedule, and they're going to want to daven at 9:15. So we're going to try and cram in as much as we can, but in a timely... we should do less.
We're not locked into 9:15.
We're not logged into 9:15. Meaning there's more of us than them.
There were other rooms in this building.
Oh, all right. So we'll go till midnight. So let's have a quick overview of what we did last time. And then from there, we'll try and establish what we're going to do this evening. Last time, we began with a fundamental question about the value of dignity, if it is a value, a human value. And we determined that essentially, historically, dignity did not have the connotation it does today of being something that makes human beings equal. Really until the 19th century, it wasn't formalized as a moral principle until after the Shoah, until after the Holocaust, when it was enshrined in the United Nations Declaration of Human Rights. It's not in the Declaration of Independence, it's not in the American Constitution. Kant is the first who seems to have touched on the idea of dignity, and of course he didn't write in English, he wrote in
German.
And it's been translated, the words that he used as dignity, but that wasn't used. But it seems clear to all of us that dignity is central, important to who we are and how we guide our lives. And we said that in Jewish thought, we have two questions. Number one, is dignity a value? And what was our answer? Yes. What's the Hebrew term that we used? Kavod HaBriot, which means honor for creatures, for creations. Kavod HaBriot, we said, and we pinpointed a whole slew of sources that indicate that human dignity is of prime importance in Jewish life. And in fact, almost all the cases we pointed to were the most debased of human beings. We had Bilam's dignity being preserved in one legend. We spoke about the dignity of the criminal who steals sheep. And has to carry it on his shoulder because of the indignity that he imposed upon himself in order to deal with his family's fortunes is given ease when it comes to the penalty. We spoke about the dignity of the criminal who's been under arrest. Maimonides of Rambam suggests that courts have immense flexibility of power with how to treat those incarceration, and said, but actually you have to beware of people's dignity. Kavod HaBriot is prime. So that was question number one. Is dignity a Jewish value? Is it a halachic value? And we determined yes. Then we asked the question, this is nice in a vacuum. When you don't have to live a real life, you can just speak about values in an abstract sense. Dignity is important. But what about when it comes to real life? When it comes up against it and you have a clash of values? The first case we had, at the time we had said Seasons or Aaron's, other stores are available for those who wish. You're walking along, you're doing your shopping, and suddenly you realize you are wearing shatnas, biblically prohibited woven threads. What do you do?
Strip
or keep walking. Those are the choices. Strip, keep walking. Well, that's the question. Well, obviously, your dignity would be infringed if you stripped. It would be uncomfortable. You would be shamed. So the question... Say again? It would be undignified, to say the least. So what happens at that point when you've got a biblical prohibition wearing shatnas and your dignity on the line? And what did we say in conclusion? You strip. And that made us all a little uncomfortable, I think. Or at least made us think twice about going shopping publicly as opposed to having it delivered to the house.
Here I am, a man, the sitzis is out, his yarmulke is on, and in public he's going to strip. Isn't Chilul Hashem a greater thing?
Well, what's Chilul Hashem?
You're going to have this nice, firm Jewish man
so here's
stripping down.
Well, this is the question. We could have another shir on Chilul Hashem generally. But it's taken to assume that Chilul Hashem means ignoring God or a lack of godliness. And the assumption is that you're right, there's human shame, but actually God is shamed more by a flagrant breach of a prohibition. The me standing here in shatness is actually a bigger Chilul Hashem than me taking my clothes off. That's what makes us uncomfortable. It's that human dignity that is so enshrined in the modern imagination, when it comes up against other values in Jewish thought, seems to fall away. Now, I've given you, you'll have two sheets, or is that correct? Yes. Two packets? There's one little supplement, which if you are caught in seasons or errands and suddenly faced with a question, you'll have a nifty little sheet to help you decide whether you need to take any action. Seriously, don't put that in your pocket and stand there in the supermarket deciding whether to strip holding this. Yeah, just give me a call. As long as I'm not there, I'll make a decision.
Maybe we need a safe space for something like that.
Maybe we do. I'm starting to think we're not going to get as far as I hoped this evening. Because we haven't actually started yet. But this is where we're up to. We try to look at cases that came up against each other, and we came in conclusion to three principles last week, based on the Gemara in Brachot, three principles. Principle number one, biblical law against human dignity, which one wins? Biblical law. That's the position the Talmud, the Gemara took, that if you are wearing biblical shatness, again, and I made this point last week, when we do shatness checking today, in 99.9 recurring percent of cases, no one's wearing biblical prohibited shatness. That would be 50% woven. I got it wrong. Is it wool or linen or cotton? What was it? Thank you. Wool and linen. You weave that together, 50%. That's biblical. But usually you got in a lapel something or a little bit of inner stitching. That would be rabbinic, which takes us to principle number two. Rabbinic law against human dignity. Which one wins?
Human dignity.
And we made the point last week, well, last month actually, that the overwhelming majority of cases of Jewish law that we confront are actually rabbinic. There are so many layers of protections against biblical law in Jewish life that most of the issues we run up against are actually rabbinic in origin. So what we'll get to at the end of this evening, if we get to the end this evening, is that this in fact is a massive gaping hole in Jewish law that scared the poskim, that scared the halachic decisors. If you start saying that rabbinic law gives way to human dignity, you've almost got rid of most of Jewish life. And you've kind of stripped back all of Jewish practice to the bare biblical practices that most of us come nowhere near on a daily basis because of all the layers of protection. And we'll get to that later this evening. But that was principle one and two. One, biblical law, human dignity, biblical law wins. Number two, rabbinic law, human dignity wins. Rule number three, actually, there are cases where biblical law gives way. What cases are those? I don't expect anybody to remember. Oh, Hashavat Aveda, that's an example of a case when one is passive. If one is passive. And the example the Gemara gives, if you're on the way to go bring Korban Pesach or to do a Brit on your newborn son, it's the eighth day, and then you see that there is a Meis Mitzvah, someone who needs to be buried, that dignity is being impinged on this figure, you can actually, for the sake of their dignity, not perform a biblical act. You have an obligation to bring a Korban Pesach, and the Gemara says you can defer that passively to take care of dignity. So three principles. Number one, biblical law overrides human dignity in general cases. Rabbinic law is overridden by human dignity, and if it's passive, you can even override biblical law. Now on this sheet, we have three of those questions answered. You're standing in the supermarket. You suddenly think, oh gosh, I seem to be wearing shatness all the way through. I knew this was a bad purchase. Number one question you ask, does this obligation conflict with human dignity? Let me ask you a question. Stripping in the middle of a supermarket, does that conflict with human dignity? Sure. Now, how do we know? Say again? Right, meaning quite literally, common sense. But this also perturbed some of the rabbinic decisors over history. Who gets to decide what's dignified and what isn't? Who gets to decide what's an impingement on my, because I don't like it? It doesn't feel right? We'll get right at the end, I guess I'll give a little spoiler now. Rabbi Soloveitchik, discussing this issue, says, I'm standing in a business meeting, I'm chatting with friends, and I see a beautiful sunset emerging, and it suddenly strikes me, ooh, I haven't davened mincha yet. But it would be a little undignified for me to step away from the meeting. It would be a little, it would almost shame me in front of my colleagues to say, I've got something religious I have to do. Embarrassing. It's embarrassing to me. Is that a lack of dignity? This almost becomes a blank check to say, any time that something gets in the way of my life, it's a lack of dignity and I just can throw it out. So who decides what's dignified and what isn't? So now we're going to come to principle number 4, top of the page, page 2. There is no objective resolution to that question, I should tell you. But in the top of the box on page 2, we do come against the issue that there are different kinds of indignities, and not everything is equal. Amar Rabba Bar Rav Huna, top source number 1. Rabba Bar Rav Huna said, Haitzuba Marabanan, the Yada Basaduta. There was this esteemed rabbinic figure who knew testimony and was issued with a subpoena. Now, we all know who've been following the news. If you've given him a subpoena, do you have to go? Oh, nobody knows. Okay. It's in the courts. Right? So if you're a rabbi and you know testimony, Vazila be milta, and it would be shameful, demeaning to you, lemeza lebeidina dezutamine, to go to the court of somebody who's of lower stature. You've been issued a subpoena by a fellow who was your chanech in camp over the summer. So now he's grown up and he's got a beis din of his own, but frankly, you know, you're much bigger than him. And now he's giving you a subpoena to go to his court. It's almost demeaning to sit there before your friend Bobby and give your testimony. No offense to Bobby, that just sprung up to my mind. Lo lazel, you don't have to go, Rabbi Rav Huna says. You don't have to go. You know testimony. You've been issued a subpoena. You're going to go. And Congress says, we're giving you a legally binding subpoena. Say, it's demeaning. I'm not coming to you. Lack of dignity. So what are we dealing with? If you know testimony, do you have an obligation to give it, generally speaking?
Yes.
Yes. Biblically or rabbinically, do you have an obligation to testify? Take a guess. 50-50. You got it. Biblical obligation, you know testimony, you've got to go give it. Okay, but your dignity is about to be impinged. You have to demean yourself to do this. It's a biblical obligation. Think about the questions that we've raised. It's biblical, so which wins?
Biblical
law, but what's the way out?
Passive.
I'm not going. I'm just going to sit home. Sounds like it works. It says, Lo nasal, don't go. Amar Rav Shesha Breder Rav Idi, Afananami Tanina, and this figure, rabbinic figure, chimes in and says, yes, we actually do have this principle. Matza Sako Kupa Ve'en Darcha Litol, if you find this object in the street, Harizelo Yitol, and it's beneath your dignity to pick it up and return it, you've got too high a stature to start dealing with this, or you earn by the minute and you're spending time dealing with small things that aren't worth the money, you don't have to do it. But then the Gemara chimes in and says, Hani Miliba Mamona, that's true with monetary law, Aval Bi'isur, but when it comes to biblical prohibitions, you know testimony. The example that the commentators give here is that there's a woman who comes to court, she says, my husband has passed away, I want to remarry. And this rabbi knows that that's not true, that the husband is still alive and they're still formally married, and he needs to go to court to give testimony so that she doesn't go off with somebody else. Mamzerim, all sorts of issues possibly result. And he's going to say, it's beneath my dignity, I'm not going. Says, no, when it comes to Isura, when it comes to prohibitions, En Chochma Vein, Tfuna Vein, Eitzel LeNeged Hashem, there is no counsel, there is no ration, there is no reason, there is no argument against God. You have to observe, even if it's impinging on your dignity. Kol makom sheyesh bo chilul Hashem, that's that phrase. Whenever there's chilul Hashem, meaning that God's law isn't being followed, ein cholkin kavod l'rav, we don't care about human dignity. So what comes out of this? We're saying you have to go. So the case is, there's a biblical obligation, I'm being passive. By our hierarchy, I should be exempt. Why do I now have to go? Is the question clear? Biblical obligation, I can be passive to avoid it, and yet the Gemara concludes, I have to go. I can't avoid it even passively. Contradiction.
Your passive will create an user.
Okay, so thank you, Tosfos. You've obviously been hanging out in medieval France. So, in source number 2, in the fourth line of source number 2, Va'ayin yud lamed va'od yesh lomar. One could say the kasha osin Israel yado lo mikra shevel tase. If it's going to lead to other prohibitions being broken, it's not called passive. That's one view. But there's another view. The first answer of Tosfos in the top line va'yesh lomar va'yud lamed, and there are those who say the hatam ganai gadol. That actually, when we're talking about you being passive and being exempt from doing mitzvot, that's talking about a big indignity, like somebody who needs burial. Or like stripping in a mall. Those are big indignities. But you being demeaned in front of your chanech, get over it. Yes, it's a little demeaning, but now we're starting to introduce gradations of indignity, and it becomes very complicated. In the next source, in the Shut Pri Yitzchak, anyone know who the Pri Yitzchak is? Excellent. You're an excellent... Say again? Oh, I was going to say you're in good company, but... We have better company, because I didn't know who he was till 2 days ago, when I thought, somebody may ask who he is, I should look that up. I was going to say Rabbi Blazer, but Blazer, you said. Blazer fits better with the graphic, but I'll accept your note. Rabbi Blazer?
Blazer.
Blazer, it's in Hebrew. Rabbi Blazer, who was, when was he born? Oh, he was a Talmud of Rav Silan, so you've got one of my facts. What year was he born in? 1837. A little disappointed, I'll admit it. Only in myself, though. He was chief rabbi of St. Petersburg and a student of Reb Zal Salanter, and he says as follows. This whole answer of Tosfos seems strange. To suggest that there are big indignities and little indignities, as we said, introduces quantifiers that we can't assess. Give us a rule book. And he says, actually, what Tosfos means when he says gadol and katan, big indignities and small indignities, is actually objectifiable. He says it means universal indignities and particular indignities. For example, stripping in a mall is undignified for anybody. And if you were to take a poll, everybody would say, even in this partisan times, if you took a poll, everyone would say that's undignified. But if you say going to testify in court, there's nothing objectively demeaning about that. It might be demeaning for particular people, depending on the context, but it's not universal. So he says these particular indignities, there's no role for that in this conversation. You have to suffer personal indignities, because that's not about the divinity in you. That's just about your persona, and you can get over that. But universal human indignity is something that we can't stand for. That's our case. So that's principle number four. That we have to first assess, is this really an indignity? I can't just take a blank check and say, okay, I'm going to get a little bit embarrassed walking away from a meeting to Daven Mincha. Who says that's an indignity? This can't be judged by my personal sentiments or sensibilities. That's the principle we needed to establish. Yeah, these sources were actually on the last source sheet, if you have it. We meant to do it last time. I see, again, we're not going to get as much done this evening. Bottom of the page underneath, we have a big principle, and we're not going to read everything inside. Now, everything we've been dealing with, you're standing in seasons, you're standing in errands, you're standing in the other places, you realize they're wearing shatnas. Oh gosh, it's biblical, this isn't quite passive, I'm walking around, I've got to take it off. Now let me ask you a question. You have that experience 1 week, they obviously put your picture up behind the register and say, watch out for this guy. You call up and apologize profusely, you show them the Gemara, you send them the YU Torah link, say, listen to the Shia, it's not my fault, I can't help it. I'll give you a couple weeks till I come back just to, you know, refresh your memories, but then I'm coming back. You come back. Next, 2 Wednesdays time, you're walking around the store, leaping through croutons and other things, and then you see over your shoulder, oh boy, this is a friend of mine, and he's wearing that suit now, and I see he's wearing the same shirt, and I really hope he's not wearing the same underwear. Do you have to go and rip it off him?
No.
You had to take it off. We said human dignity against biblical prohibition goes out the window. You had to strip. You've got a friend there. His dignity or her dignity is at stake. And now there's a biblical prohibition. You know for a fact it's the same suit, let's say. You know for a fact it's the same suit. They told you, they bought it with you 2 weeks ago in the same store. You forgot to mention it to them and now they're wearing it in the store. Do you have to walk up to them and say, I may have to cancel our lunch this Shabbos, but I'm afraid I'm going to have to take your clothes off you? Yes? No?
Tell them that's a Shabbos.
You're not
tell the police. There,
okay.
You have to tell them that.
No, no, no. Don't tell them.
Don't tell them. Don't tell them.
He has to do it.
Okay, excellent. We've got an interesting diversity of views.
Don't you have to tell somebody if they're doing something wrong? Isn't
that
amazing? No, right.
Don't
make them amazing.
Do you tell somebody that the Erev is down?
Oh, interesting. Right, the Erev is down. Do you tell people when the Erev is down?
No.
Oh, so this is obviously an interesting question with lots of views. So,
why would you not tell somebody the Erev is down?
No, why would you have the
father
down?
Why is the
Erev down?
They're
walking
the street.
So this is a complicated issue. Someone's in the street, they're pushing two children in a stroller, they're halfway up the hill in the middle of Holliswood, and you say, oh, the Erev is down. Okay, I guess I'll carry them with a shinui. I don't know what I'll do with the kids. Again, this is not a psak session, but the general view is, it's better to leave someone doing something b'shogeg, inadvertently, or non-deliberately, than it is to make them do it mazid, in certain cases. In certain cases. So what about our case? Standing there wearing shatnez, it's a biblical prohibition. We've said biblical law overrides dignity. That being said, this is a debate between the medieval poskim. I'm not going to ask you to raise your hands between who's Ashkenazi and who's Sephardi, but it is going to break down along those lines as to how we view this. You may get kidney oat, but I'd watch out when you go shopping. The Ashkenazi view here is that when it comes to other people's indignity, don't say anything until they get home. You should tell them. But if you're in the store, you see them wearing the suit, the best thing to do is actually either to wait till they get home or say, oh, I need to, can you just come with me? I need to go home very quickly. I need you to come with me. And then when you get home, take them to a room where there's privacy. At this point, they're thinking, I was in the middle of getting croutons. They're driving me crazy. But you say, you're wearing shatnez, and instantly you need to take this off. I'll close the door. This is spare clothes. Right? Look at Rambam. Source number 5. Haroa kilaim shel Torah al chavero. If you see biblically prohibited kilaim on your friend, for now, afilu haya mahalach bashuk, even if you're walking in the marketplace, kofetz lo, v'koro alav miyad. He doesn't seem to say do this with gentility, jump on him and rip it off him straight away. Afilu haya rabo shalom de chachma. Even if this is a figure who taught you your Torah, jump on your teacher and rip your clothes off. Now, this is all not assuming we did this in high school anyway. But this is later in life when you've developed a good relationship with the teacher. Rip it off. She'en covered habrias dochi isilo tasem afirsh b'Torah, because covered habrias, human dignity, does not override biblical prohibitions. And the Shulchan Aruch says, following the Rambam, you have to rip it off. And the Ramah, in brackets, never has there been a more useful brackets in the Ramah, says actually you should leave them in shogeg, that they're doing it inadvertently, and then later you should tell them they have to take this off. Yeah.
Case of Erev might be different. Let me explain. As Rob knows, the Ritva in Be'ez Aflama discusses the case of not telling people who are eating in a time before Yom HaKippurim, when it is biblically forbidden, but that is, at the biblical level, not derived directly from a pasuk. It's just from a drasha gemara.
Mm-hmm.
Here it's mutav shiyoshovin vayu mazidin. So I think Erev is more similar to that, but shatnez is explicitly...
Well, Erev is different for a couple of reasons. One of the reasons being...
at the biblical level.
Right, you can only have an Erev if it would be prohibited rabbinically to carry, not biblically. So the whole issue is on a different level. Absolutely. So let's turn over to page 3. We've now established our decision-making chart has now been filled in. We're now going to do, and even though we're somewhat short on time, I'm not worried actually, because we're all going to just look at cases now. We don't have to read everything inside, but we're going to explore different cases that have been brought to rabbinic figures over history where there's an issue of dignity against biblical law, and some of these cases are mind-blowing. Some of them are somewhat humorous, some of them are pretty mundane. We'll try and ignore the mundane ones, but some of them are really astonishing. Again, on this sheet, you have 4 questions. Number 1, does the obligation actually conflict with human dignity? Am I overselling the indignity this will cause, or is this universal human dignity? If it is not a problem of dignity, you take the chart to the right and you're obligated. You still have to keep the law. I don't know why I chose these particular colors. Next question. If it is a conflict with human dignity, is this a biblical or rabbinic obligation? If it's a rabbinic obligation, you are exempt. If it's biblical, keep going. Would it involve an active or passive violation? If it's passive, you are exempt. Still keep going if it's biblical and is active. Would it involve an intentional or unintentional violation? Now, the only way this actually comes to be a case is if it's somebody else. It's very hard to imagine that you are conscious of unintentionally breaking a law for the sake of your dignity. So really this falls down to, should I rip something off somebody else? Which we've said, the answer is you fall into a waiting pattern and you don't do anything about that. And that's going to come important in a minute. So page 3, this is actually, again, in a vacuum when we're not dealing with conflicting halachic reasoning, but just different cases where dignity is central in the way that we behave. Top page is actually a discussion in the Sitz Eliezer. Any doctors in the room? Let me ask this differently. Anyone not a doctor in the room? There you go. Okay, a couple of us. So doctors take a Hippocratic oath, at least in the UK. They have the same one here. Does it involve a line about insurance or something? Because in the UK it doesn't. So you take a Hippocratic oath. Part of the Hippocratic oath, I think, if I'm not incorrect, is confidentiality. Is that correct? There you go, it's been too long. But we assume that it includes levels of confidentiality. At least in Sitz Eliezer's case was, doctor said, I took an oath to keep confidential. Now, while I'm taking my rounds on the hospital, trailed by my students, again, I don't know if this is how residencies work anymore, but students are going to come in with me and I'm going to talk to them all about this unfortunate person's condition while they're sitting there thinking, could I have a little bit of privacy, please? I don't need an audience. In fact, that picture there is what surgery used to look like. They lay you on a table. They didn't have computer programs and they thought, what a great way to teach. So you're lying there. They also didn't have full anesthetic at the time. So you're lying there conscious with 200 people watching your innards being messed around with. I think we would all call that somewhat undignified, at least from the, say, patient's perspective. So he asked a question, or somebody asked him a question, can I take students around with me? I took an oath to keep secrets and be confidential. He says, number one, it's implicit. Everybody knows as a doctor that you're going to have students, so when you take that oath, it's not a nadir, I'm never going to talk to students, it's understood you're going to do that. Number two, he says, actually, as a principal, having students is actually part of the medical diagnostic procedure. We all know that you learn more from your students, sometimes more than your teachers. Often the students who don't have a background will ask a question. Anybody ever see House? You often have people in House who was the I don't know if arrogant, conceited, British with an American accent figure, who often would hear somebody innocent say something that meant nothing. That makes me think outside the box, and that actually helps diagnostically. So he says, obviously, you should be doing that because it'll help the patient. But, despite the oath, there's another reason not to drag students in, which is privacy. Privacy. This is the underlined bit in the third paragraph. Ela shemibchina acheret. Forget the oath for a minute. Yesh ladunal dava asifat harofa misaviv lamata achol estudentim talmidim umarin lehem mekome negim achla v'shitche egof. Forget the oath for a minute. We need to think about this. You're standing in a room with a patient, surrounding the patient with students, having conversation, chatting. Oh, what did you think about that patient? What do you think about this? What do you think of this liver? And the patient's sitting there, feeling picked apart. This is embarrassing. This can be shame-inducing to patients. And especially when there are gender differentials, you have a man patient or a female patient sitting there with students of the opposite gender around the bed. It feels uncomfortable. And he says, actually, putting aside the oath, putting aside the diagnostic capacity, it should be prohibited from a halachic perspective to bring students in without permission. And I actually think that's the American code now. You correct me if I'm wrong, you need a patient's permission to bring students in and have a discussion. Is that right? Okay, there you go. And even if it's not, you'd have to look it up if someone complained, and then you'd figure it out. But that's his view. And again, this is where dignity is in a vacuum as a value. We have to employ it. Bottom of the page is a separate issue, which is about taking chumras, being more machmeh than other people. The Gemara suggests in the Yerushalmi that being machmeh is wonderful in a vacuum. But if you do it surrounded by people who don't want to live that way, and it makes them feel less than, that's improper. That's actually an impingement on other people's dignity by making them feel inferior for doing what is right. And one should be very careful when being machmeh. I'm sure many of you will enjoy saying this to people. So I just thought I'd share that with you. Page 4. And here we come with some interesting cases. Let's do source 12 first, because it's the more surprising one. In the old days, when they had yeshivas, they didn't have dormitories. Back in Europe, I'd say back in the good old days, but they were pretty horrific. But nostalgically, we can imagine they were the good old days. You didn't have dormitories, so where did young men stay when they went to study?
Families in the community.
They stayed with families in the community. People open up their homes and have people stay in their house. So there was one case where a very righteous and pious young man staying in one of the families of the community started having an affair with the woman of the house. And it went on for 3 years. Yeah, this isn't good. Yes, this is bad. And then he thought, how can I make this hyper awkward? And he got engaged to her daughter.
You.
Yeah, that's a fun Thanksgiving. So, at the time where he was getting engaged to the daughter, he'd actually done repentance. Again, this question was issued to the Noda B'Yehuda, and he said, look, I had somewhat checkered past. I've done tshuva. I feel remorse, regret. I wish I could take this back, and I can't. I'm now engaged to the daughter, and I've now got a question. Now, his question is, number one, how do I do tshuva for this? People would often turn to rabbis and say, how do I do tshuva for this? And I said, well, I don't know. Good luck. Right? But you're not meant to say that as a rabbi. But then there was a second question. And don't take this as psak to tell people. No one should read this. I have a friend who gave a shir on this subject, and it led to a number of divorces because he didn't qualify the statement. So this is not a psak. I'm saying this is a general principle, that it is prohibited for a man and woman to live together if she has had an affair. If she has had an affair, they cannot be intimate. So now the son-in-law-to-be thinks he has to tell his father-in-law that he had an affair with his wife and they can't live together anymore. It's not just an awkward Thanksgiving. That's going to be an awkward wedding. Yeah. Which side of the chuppah do you stand? It's all complicated. So he comes to the Nodbihud and says, do I have to tell him that he's actually violating biblical prohibitions every time that he's together with his wife?
He knows.
Okay. One option is he knows. Leave him alone. Well, what's at stake here? If he does tell him, what's the fallout? And why would we say don't tell him?
Okay.
Shalom bias. Shalom bias, okay. Okay, interesting. Thank you, right. I mean, that's the subject of the shir, so we're going to come to that. There's a kavod mishpacha. It turns out that this was an esteemed family, whatever that might mean. And this would have been the talk of the town, as it is for us now, even in anonymity. Imagine we knew who this was. This would be front page New York Times. This is this would be shredding of their dignity. So the question is,
nobody would invite any
yeshiva. Yeah, it would also ruin the yeshiva industry at the time, possibly. That's a good point. But that's what's at stake here. There's a biblical prohibition being violated every time that they are together. And if I don't say something, I can preserve dignity. So let's ask ourselves the question. Does it conflict with human dignity? Yeah, let's agree with that. This would be an impingement on human dignity. Is this a biblical or rabbinic prohibition that we're looking at being violated?
Neither.
So the husband sleeping with his wife is biblically prohibited. Okay, so let's, well, it's not actually true if he knows. I mean, let's say in general, you're right, he's shogeg right now, but the principle of the prohibition generally is biblical. Okay, so dignity gives way before that. Now the question is this an active or passive violation? This is active. They would be intimate together. That's usually active. I'm not going to get into the details on that. This is active. The next question is then, that would actually be an interesting discussion for another time. Not for now. The next question, would this be intentional or unintentional? Unintentional. So what do we say when it's unintentional, active violation of a biblical prohibition? It's in blue. Yes, take the sheet out at home, send it around. Waiting pattern, meaning don't tell him. Don't tell him. And actually, who says don't tell him? Who did we say when it comes to somebody else's dignity, don't get involved? Ashkenazim. Let's hope they go to an Ashkenazi rabbi for this. Because the Noda Behuda says this is actually the debate between the Rosh and the Rambam, between the Shulchan Aruch and the Ramah, between Ashkenazim and Sfardim. And if they were Sfardi, it doesn't matter, intentional, not intentional. There's a prohibition being violated. It doesn't matter if it's Shogeg or not. This is a biblical prohibition. Kavod can go out the window. So if you're Ashkenazim, don't say a word. But then he says, hold on a minute, even if you're Ashkenazim, and we say waiting pattern, what does waiting pattern usually mean?
Eventually.
This is for a minute, till you get home, till you get around the corner, till this resolves itself. But this would be for the rest of his life. That's not a waiting pattern. Say again?
Until she dies.
Until she dies or he dies, right? This is the rest of the marriage, let's say. That's not a temporary fix. That's not a waiting pattern. That's just a default. And he says, so even the Ashkenazim think you should tell him. In the next source, number 13, we've got the Yabia Omer, who is... anyone know Yabia Omer? Ravadi Yosef. Ravadi Yosef says, in this case, Hamorim Mekol Ha'amor, at the end of the day, this is a complicated case. It's somewhat astonishing that they were dealing with these issues. And the conclusion the Noda Behuda reaches is, you have to tell him. That is an awkward wedding. As we said, awkward Thanksgiving. Hi, Mum, Dad. This is a little awkward. And the Rav Avadia Yosef says, Kedei shelo tinol delet bifnei hashavim b'tshuva. In order not to lock the doors before those who want to repent, in order not to put off those who try to come back to the community, meaning this young man who lived, as we say, this somewhat checkered past, is now trying to live a righteous life. And what are we going to say? Now that you've reestablished, you've rehabilitated yourself, you're going to settle down, you're going to build a family and be a productive part of society, we're going to say, you now have to shatter all of that. You have to go and break up the family, ruin your... Obviously, this marriage isn't going to happen if you tell your mother-in-law-to-be, your father-in-law-to-be. This is going to fall. You're going to ruin everything. And the Noda Behuda says you've got to tell them. Dignity goes out the window. Biblical prohibitions are being violated. And Rav Avadia Yosef says at the end of the day, we're actually... And he, if we want to talk about Sfardim, is the major authority in the last 100 years for the Sfardi community, says at the end of the day, we're going to lean towards saying, don't say a word. We want people to be able to find their way back to religious life. This doesn't overrule anything, but here we've got covered Habrias. Yecholim lahakel shelo lahodia lebal ha'isha. You can be lenient and not tell the husband. Meshum pekam mishbacha v'gadol kavod Habrios. Dignity. Now, I'm not going to get historicist and say, because Rav Avadia Yosef lived in our century and lived in a culture where dignity was so vital, and the Noda Behuda was 300 years ago when dignity was actually an indication of nobility. As we said, a dignitary was an indication of not equality, but someone higher. So they were dealing with different cultures. It's possible that that inflected the way that we think about this today. But Rav Avadia says, bottom line, we want people to feel like they can come back. And there is a mechanics, halachically, to say, don't say a word. Keep it passive. Waiting pattern. So it's a longer waiting pattern than it is to get home. But this is a waiting pattern, and we keep it that way, and we keep families together, and we keep people together, and we let people repent their wrongs. Yeah.
It seems like there are different... The concept of kavod habriyot is for different individuals.
What do you mean?
In other words, Rabbi Avadia Yosef is concerned about the kavod habriyot of the Baal Tshuva. Whereas I think we were talking about the kavod habriyot of the father-in-law.
He is using the Baal Tshuva, the young man's circumstances as an additional factor to push in the direction of leniency. That's correct. It's not really his dignity per se, it's his whole life, religious life.
That's all kavod habriyot, but he's talking about
It seems to me, it's somewhat ambiguous. It seems to me that he's saying the issue of Kavod HaBrios is this entire circumstance. You've got his dignity, the parents' dignity, the family's dignity, the mother's, everyone's dignity is going to be shredded here. And because this will, meaning this doesn't do favours for Jewish life. Chil HaShem in the more contemporary colloquial sense is being violated here. So let's use this halachic system that's in place to keep this waiting pattern on an extended schedule.
But it seems to be focused on the
son-in-law,
potential son-in-law, could be a Baal
Tshuva. It could be. He says, Pagam Mishbacha. Presumably that's something to do with him.
Doesn't the wife have to do Tshuva too?
Presumably. Yeah, no one's asked her about this. Presumably, yeah. Maybe, I don't know what his side conversation to this written piece was. Maybe he said, by the way, don't tell the husband, but maybe you should have a chat with this woman and say she needs to do Tshuva. Or maybe you just shouldn't talk to her, right? I don't want you to sing quietly in a room talking about what you should plan for the future. We know what happened last time. Okay. Two more cases on this page. Yeah.
So I was just going to say, I mean, we know that ultimately justice will happen, one way or the other.
Meaning in one world or the other?
Well, one way or the other, the justice will happen, will take place. Question is, you know, how does that unfold, right? If the news comes out, right, that what happened, and the whole family gets destroyed, okay, so that's one way of having justice done. The other way is...
What do you mean, justice?
Justice.
Meaning, what did the husband do?
What did the husband?
Or the daughter.
What do you mean, or the daughter. Are you saying the truth, not justice? What do you mean?
Justice. I
mean, justice for whom?
It's a just world. Right? God created justice.
Okay, so now we're leaning into a different subject, which is providence, justice. I think we can all agree that on some level there are things that don't seem just to us, at least in the world. And the question of how to negotiate that into providence is complicated. We'll come back to that around Elul time. But in terms of how to deal with this concretely, we seem to be saying, keep quiet. And we'll come to other cases where this comes up. And in fact, these are not just abstract cases. When I first came across one of these cases in Chicago, I was discussing it with a rabbi. I said, yeah, I had this case. Actually, someone came to me with this question and I had to give an answer to it. We'll come to it.
So the only thing I'm saying is that maybe in this day and age, that's the just way to go.
Which way? Not to say anything.
Not to tell.
Oh, it could be, right, it could be that we're inflected by a culture in which people's dignity is so much more, meaning back in the day when people were struggling to eat, the question of personal dignity on the pyramid of needs was a little displaced. In an age when, thank God, most of us are capable of eating and feeding ourselves and clothing ourselves, the dignity kind of standard is far higher. That's possible. Okay, two more cases on this page. Any Kohanim in the room? Okay, scared to say? A couple. Bottom box 14, the top box we'll come back to. Sheila, another time. 14. Kohen shochev al mitato. You've got a Kohen sleeping on his bed. Upashat kol bagadab kederach olam. And he sleeps like everybody sleeps. Without any clothes on. This again was a different time. Upito, right. So he wanted to go to Seasons, but he went home. He's lying in bed and he's sleeping. It's a hot evening. They don't have air conditioning, and he was sleeping without clothes. Pitom Karolova Amru. Suddenly, someone comes in and cries out, "Echad made ba'ohel." There's a dead body in here. Cohen suddenly has anxiety and thinks, "Oh boy, I wish I'd worn something." Tzarechu likpotz arum mamash ulerotz chusol. Do you have to get up and run outside naked? Kadesh lo yisha betuma, so that you're not in tuma. Oh, sharim mashum kavod abrios. Or do we say because of dignity, you can l'shos ba'ol adasha yilbosh miksas begadam, until you can put some clothes on? So let's ask a question: is it a biblical or rabbinic prohibition for a Cohen to become tummy? It's a biblical prohibition. Oh, this is a bad start, right? Mm-hmm. Biblical prohibition, so which wins? The biblical prohibition. So what would you say? Is this a passive or active violation, being in the tumah?
Mm-hmm. Oh, hell is not explicit, maybe, and therefore it's going to
end up. Maybe. Okay. Well, yeah. Let's say this way. You're standing there, you're a Cohen, somebody calls out, "There's Tame in here," and every minute you're there, halakhically we consider that be actively present, you are violating a prohibition. Every moment you wait, you're violating a prohibition. Sounds like from our Richter scale here, this is active. Is it intentional or unintentional? Someone calls out, there's a dead body. I know it now. I can't unknow that. It's now intentional. So what do you have to do? Out you go. You won't sleep laying the nip again. Tshuva. Yeah, any kohanim here with anxiety now know you have to wear pajamas. Yira, it seems to me, the mishum kavod habriyos lo naseh shum isa d'oraisa. When it comes to dignity, that doesn't mean you can breach biblical prohibitions. Yes, if you're a kohen and someone calls out, there's a dead body, up you get. You don't have time to put on your trousers or your robe or whatever else, you're out. Vishu b'tumaso al mes l'kohen isa d'oraisa. It's a biblical prohibition. Amnam, oto shakarin l'kohen. He now says as a side point, that's your question, good question. As a side point, let me talk to that guy who ran into the room saying, there's a dead body. Here's my advice for you. Yizharu, be careful, b'tchila shelo yagidu lo miyad. Don't tell him that there's a dead body in the room. Sheyesh med ba'ol, ela yikro lo bistam. I don't know how this is going to go down. 3 a.m, wake him up and say, I need to tell you something. Come with me. Say, get out of here. 3 a.m, I'm asleep. I really, really need to tell you something. I don't want to tell you right. Tell me now. I'm lying down. Just tell me. I can't tell you. Come with me. And you've got to kind of drag him out and say, put your robe on. All right, I'll put my robe on. He's going to be irritated. But when you tell him outside why, he's going to be less irritated that you didn't tell him, because at least he's wearing a robe. So those are cases of biblical law when they conflict with dignity. We do have points at which dignity gives way. There are suggestions, if it's unintentional, it's a waiting pattern, and that's actually the overarching theme of these two cases. If it's unintentional, the husband is unintentionally violating prohibition when he's intimate with his wife, and the Kohen is unintentionally violating prohibitions when he's sitting in the impurity. And we say to actually leave them in that unintentional waiting pattern. For the Kohen, it's until he gets outside, and it seems for this husband, it's until he gets to the other side, that we leave them in that state. Now, turn the page. Page 5. We said rabbinic sins is a different story. Rabbinic sins automatically, when it comes to rabbinic prohibitions, rabbinic law gives way to dignity. So what are some cases here? Top of the page, and I apologize for this theme again. There are difficult cases. If someone passes away on Shabbat, and firstly the body is now mukta, there's nothing you can do for the person's health anymore, so making calls is questionable. And actually, the bottom line, and as a rabbi, this is kind of a panicky thing, because often you get time to look questions up. And sometimes questions don't have high stakes. But if someone comes to me Shabbos morning, in the middle of Psukei Dezimra, and says, somebody's just passed away in my house, I can't say, let me make some calls. I can't say, let me look this up. I can't say, give me a second while I run next to one, panic, and then think about this. I have to know what to do. And I can't tell you the number of times I've asked different mentors and rabbis, what do we do in that case? And I still feel like, I don't have 100% of a solid answer. Maybe it's just an existentially difficult situation, because it is an uncomfortable reality, which is, you leave the body, you cover it, and you leave the body where it is. If it's in a bed, if it's on a couch, if it's in the sofa, this body, you can't move it. So there then becomes a question in the old days when they didn't have air conditioning, and it's a boiling hot summer, and somebody passes away in the middle of the night, and you've got hours and hours and hours till Shabbos, and this becomes undignified for the person and for the people around. So what do you do? And there's a suggestion that actually you can move the body to a place that would involve violating carrying on Shabbos if it's only a rabbinic violation, because this is about dignity, and dignity overrules rabbinic prohibitions. And I should say again, when it comes to Shabbos, you shouldn't take this again as a blank check, but most of the things that we're used to not doing on Shabbos are rabbinic in nature, because again, so many layers of protection. Again, none of you are threshing on Shabbos. No one is going to start winnowing, if anyone knows even how to winnow. Isn't that the noise a horse makes? Winning. Thank you. There you go. Either way, don't do either of those on Shabbos. So there are so many layers of protections that most of what we do is rabbinic. And when it comes to dignity, it seems, again, on Shabbos, so much would fall away to preserve dignity. And then the onus comes to us to determine what is dignity. What is an indignity? So that's case number 1, sources 15 and 16. Case number 17. Now, anyone familiar with the prohibition of tchum on Shabbos? What's tchum? It's a boundary from which you're not allowed to go out of on Shabbos. There's carrying on Shabbos, which is a problem. When you have an Erev, that solves that. And there's a Tchum, which is there's a boundary to your habitation. Living in a city, it never really comes up, because there's a 2,000 amos distance around every city, which is counted as your Tchum. But if you go on a hiking trip for Shabbos, and you're in the middle of nowhere, there are no houses, there's no cities nearby, you're in the middle of the Rocky Mountains, you actually have a very limited Tchum around you. Again, 2,000 amos in any direction, from which you can't walk. What happens if you get to the very boundary, and you know it's 2,000 amos here, and you say, ah, forget it. Tchum, I don't care, I'm in such a bad mood. And you say, I'm out. And you go for a walk, and then along the way, as you're meandering through the Rocky Mountains, you're inspired by the vista, you reconnect with God, and you say, that was wrong, I shouldn't have done that. Can you go back? There's a rabbinic fine. You get 4 amos in any direction. That's it. So you're sitting there, I've got to do what's right. I'm going to have these 4 amos in the middle of the mountain. There are coyotes, but I'll be okay. It's been a couple hours, and you need the loo. You know how 4 amos, that's a bathroom, for anybody concerned. You've got 4 amos in any direction, you need the bathroom. Tough luck, mate. What do you do? There's an issue of dignity here, presumably. And the answer is yes, there is dignity here. And when it comes to chum, the prohibition is rabbinic. And we say, you can go and find somewhere private to go to the bathroom. And they give advice, if you go back and you don't find somewhere private until you get back into your original tchum, you get your tchum back. So I advise you to go back in that direction, not in the other direction. And actually, historically, it's interesting, there's a discussion about how far can you go. Let's say you find a private house, but it belongs to your non-Jewish neighbors, who you're a little concerned may pull a trick on you, or may hit you, or mock you. The Mishnah Berurah says, obviously, that's not a safe place. You can keep going. Again, we may live in a different age when you don't feel... you come to the first house, you're going to say, I'm just going to use the bathroom. I'm not that worried. There's a lock on the door. I'm not worried. But the suggestion is you can breach that. Something else, and I remember this from when I was in high school. I grew up, as I think I've mentioned in the past, in a traditional home, an observant home, an Orthodox home. But in England, a lot of the observant traditional Orthodox families, most, I think 80% of affiliation is Orthodox. But halachic literacy is somewhat low. And I remember we'd go to school, we'd have our more right-wing rabbis teach us, and we'd come home and we'd tell all these halachic things we'd learned to our parents, which they'd say, you guys are insane. What are you talking about? I remember a couple of these times that we came home, some friends of mine came home, told their parents they need to check things for shatnas, maybe you need to check your sheets for shatnas, said, oh, what are we doing? Just forget, what are you talking about? You're insane. Again, education, Jewish education in England is free. So at least they didn't say, I'm spending 20 grand on you coming back telling me this. But then there was another case, tearing toilet paper on Shabbos. That was a contentious issue. Again, you grow up thinking you're observant and you're raising your kids, and they come home and tell you can't tear toilet paper on Shabbos, and you think, you guys are crazy, leave me alone. And then somebody suggested, well, actually we were told that you can tear it if you use your elbow and your teeth. Yeah. This is roughly how it went down around the table. But that is a discussion here. It is a prohibition to tear. In fact, that is one of the 39 problems. Tearing on Shabbos along perforations is a problem. But if one needs to maintain one's dignity and hygiene and sanitation, again, rabbinic law gives way. This isn't, again, a blank check to do whatever you want, but if one is in a situation, one's in a bathroom, there are no tissues, there's only toilet paper, you don't have to say, okay, this is going to be uncomfortable for a few hours. You say, maybe use your teeth. Find a way to rip the paper, not on the perforations. Again, you don't have to start, gnawing at it, but tear not on the perforations, and that's a breach of rabbinic law. You can't sit there tearing paper ordinarily on Shabbos. It's a rabbinic prohibition. But if it comes to dignity, that gives way. I should also point out that I don't know who designed the Shabbos toilet paper in shuls. Anyone know what I'm talking about? That you can never get it out, you're breaking your fingers, that you're using kippah clips to try and get it, whatever it is. There's another way out if you're having trouble. Either way, bottom of the page, we're going to have to move on. Bottom of the page, there's an interesting idea. Let's turn the page. This actually comes up a lot. Page 6, right at the top. Young married couple, first get married, because they're a young married couple. and they're learning the halachot of nida and harchakot. Harchakot are various distant boundaries, again, protective layers that one practices to avoid intimacy during periods of nida. Some of those harchakot can be pervasive into the way we live and very disruptive to the way we live. One of the harchakot observed during the period of nida is not passing things to one another. Now, there are exceptions to this for various people. I've seen people, new married couples with newborn babies, holding a baby outside and putting the baby on the floor, or putting the baby on top of the car, saying, "You pick it up, I can't pass it to you." Rav Willing and others think that's ridiculous, and you can pass a baby. But this will happen, you know, you're living in the Heights, come on in. We're wrapping up momentarily. If we don't, we'll relocate Marv, but I'll try to wrap up. This comes up a lot. Young couples get married, live in the Heights, and then you're sitting there, and suddenly you realize everyone's attentive to this stuff, because you've just learned this all in your chasn and kala classes. And people are kind of looking around, and you see, you're sitting at the table, someone passes you a dish, you're sitting next to your husband or your wife, you're in the Heights, so everyone's got small tables, everyone's on odd chairs, and you can't put it down on the table, and you just, oh, maybe pass it back there. Say, no, we've had it, pass it that way. Oh, then you panic, you don't know what to do, and you're balancing it on your knee while you're taking something else, and like half pick it up, and it's just awkward, and it draws massive amounts of attention to this. And Rav Moshe Feinstein was asked this question, is this a violation of my dignity? And harchakot rabbinic, can we just forget it? And just in that instance, just say, Just take it. Just let's not draw attention to this. And actually, his answer is not that comforting to young couples who are looking for help. And again, I'm not saying this is the final word. We're just exploring issues here. If you have questions, follow up with me. But Moshe says, in a more gentle way, get over it. That's not it. That's not indignity. In the old days, do you know what would happen during the period of Nidah 2,000 years ago? Women would wear different colored clothing. It would be obvious to everybody, and everybody should understand that this was part of biological, married, Jewish life. And it happens to people who are in that period, people are not in that period, so at the table, you don't pass it. You say, "I'm sorry, I can't pass it." So, okay, people will understand, and you'll move on. Again, we may live in a culture where it becomes more awkward and uncomfortable, and again, you should ask questions of people you feel comfortable asking questions to, but that's his view. And he says, and if you're in a world where you're not dealing with all those people, you're around the table with some friends from work, and they're not going to understand one bit. You say, "I can't pass it." You can't pass it to your wife? This is strange. I mean, the number of times I've had to explain to movers why my wife and I have different beds and they think that we're going through issues, and I'm trying to explain, no, like, why do I have to tell you about this? Just move my stuff. either way, there are... he suggests that this shouldn't be a matter of shame. And I remember actually when I was in Gush, and you know how yeshiva people eat, somebody spilled chulen on my jacket, on my shirt. And I'm thinking, you know, I'm a yeshiva guy, how many shirts have I got? I can only turn it inside out so many times. What do I do? Can I rub this out on shirts? And I see the rabbi, and he said, "Oh, you think that stain is an indignity? It is the highest dignity. It's a badge of honor. You having that there is your testament to the world that you're not willing to break Shabbos for this. Wouldn't you be more proud of that?" I thought, okay. Either way, the argument Rav Moshe makes here is similar. It's like, this is our way of life. Yes, it can be awkward. Yes, it can be uncomfortable. But why should you be ashamed? This is how Kodesh Baruch Hu wants us to live, and there's deep value. Adhering value in this to suggest that, no, we shouldn't be passing, because this is a moment of reflection, a moment when there isn't intimacy, so that we can rebuild our relationship on other planes. And I'm not passing right now. And be comfortable with that. That's his suggestion.
Is he redefining what
it seems to me that everybody is defining their own terms as we discuss this, which is why this is an amorphous issue, which we'll finish with. Who's here for Maariv? We're over time, and I don't want any...
There is no scheduled Maariv.
There is not a scheduled Maariv?
Because we had Mincha and Maariv.
Isn't there 9:15 every day?
Not tonight.
You've decided? Somebody's saying Kaddish.
I know, so we'll daven.
Will daven, will daven.
We'll daven in a few minutes.
Are you okay hanging for a few minutes? Or do you have to run? You have to run. So... No, you're an esteemed member of the community. I think we can find you a Maariv.
There's a 9:45 with the young man.
It's scheduled for 9:15 today, right? So we should have a minion of people.
No.
Well, either way, I feel undignified.
Is it passive or is it?
All right, I was passive there. As long as we're not passive aggressive, we'll be fine. Source number 27. Again, we're going to rack through this very quickly, and I'm going to have to give him a call later and apologize. We're going to rack through this quickly. Source number 27. 2 years ago, I'm in Chicago. I'm leading a group of 22 deacons around my shul. What is a deacon? Yeah, basically. It's a priest who can get married in the Catholic Church. You're basically an assistant rabbi, but you can't do the sacraments and all sorts of things. And they wanted to do some interfaith, and the senior rabbi at my shul was away on a trip somewhere, and they said, oh, you're an assistant rabbi, can you show him around? I thought, okay, you know, I do what I'm told. So I showed him around. One of the questions I began by saying, I'm not going to just talk at you. I want to get a sense for what you're interested in, what your questions are, what about Jewish life perturbs you. And one person, hand went straight up, this life and the next life. When does this life begin for Jewish people, and what happens in the next life for Jewish people? I thought, oh, so we're starting light. Good. And it turns out that the issue of abortion is far more complicated. If we ask generally, you know, are we pro-life or pro-choice? It doesn't quite fall along those lines. Is a prohibition against abortion in Jewish law biblical or rabbinic?
Is a prohibition?
There is a good question. Is there, let's start there. Is there a prohibition on abortion in Jewish law, in halacha? Let me ask you a question. Is there a prohibition on me cutting my finger in Jewish law?
Yeah.
So let's presume if there's a prohibition on me cutting my finger, any damage or any cutting to my body is a prohibition. So the question then becomes, is it biblical or rabbinic? So it's complicated. Complicated. Meaning, to just have an abortion for the sake of having abortion is clearly problematic.
But to preserve the mental health of the mother.
Okay, so now the question becomes, I can do elective surgery. There's a question about cutting me is a problem. But if I wanted to have plastic surgery, a nose job, these things are discussed. And you can do productive surgeries, which involves cutting, in various circumstances. So if an abortion, you're in a case where a mother says, this is the thing, by the way, I don't get about the Catholic position that some politicians have taken, that I'm pro-life apart from cases of rape and the safety of the mother. Safety of the mother I get, you've got two lives in the balance. The cases of rape, that sounds to me like they just don't really hold the Catholic view. Meaning, if this woman had given birth and then found out that this child was a product of rape, I don't think anyone would say you could kill the child, right? Am I right?
Right.
So what difference does it make? From the Catholic view, life starts at conception. Birth is an unimportant phase. So I don't know why that exception is made, apart from to get votes, they don't want to alienate people. Putting that to the side, the Jewish view on abortion is complicated. And essentially there are some who think it's a biblical prohibition, there are some who think it's a rabbinic prohibition, there are some who think that it's kind of a weak rabbinic prohibition, and in the mystical tradition it's one of the most horrific things one can do. So it depends who you ask on your view, but there are a number of times, many, 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 many cases in which halakhic authorities have said, you are permitted, in fact not only permitted, we encourage you to have an abortion, to maintain all sorts of mental, financial, whatever the issues are, it's not straightforward. And for us as a community to kind of blanket support the pro-life position that it should be prohibited and illegal would actually cause a number of issues in halakhic literature where women would have to go to other states to have halakhically permissible abortions because the Catholic enshrined view has made it illegal. So it's complicated. And the question is, let's say there's a young woman who has an affair, gets pregnant, hasn't told her husband, she's not showing. She thinks, I can either have this abortion right now and avoid the whole issue, or am I going to have to raise this child and tell my husband that I had an affair and all sorts of things. It may be sensible to have that discussion either way for the health of the marriage, but let's say you want to sweep it under the rug and avoid it. Is that a circumstance, kavod habrios, the dignity of the marriage, the family, all sorts of things, in which we say, go and have the abortion? If it's biblical prohibition, what's the answer? Biblical prohibitions don't go away for the sake of dignity unless it's passive, and actively ending a fetus's life is not passive. This would be intentional. The only way around it is if this is rabbinic. And there are views that suggest that you can endorse abortions in cases when there is kavod habrios, to save a marriage, let's say.
The Eichritz was asked that question in the case of rape. There was no
Kalkola's husband involved, and he ruled for the mental health of the woman who would have to look at this, at presumably the rapist's face on that baby for the rest of that child's life that overlaps
right.
hers. She may abort him during the first 40 days.
Yeah.
I thought you said that he could not live with her, and the husband couldn't live with her anyway after this.
Yeah, so then does she have to tell him?
No, that was Shalai Baratzi, he's not a Kohen.
No, we said if she's been unfaithful, they're not allowed to live together. So yeah, the general assumption is if he knows about it, it's prohibited. And again, a friend of mine, actually, I think it was a friend of mine, I don't know who it was, gave a shiur on that subject in Riverdale, and it led to about 3 divorces. Because he didn't qualify it, and people said, I guess this is, we have to sort this out. There are all sorts of ways in which halachic literature has dealt with this. You don't believe her, even if she insists halachically, we don't, whatever it is. But you're right, in theory, that principle is enforced. We're going to have to wrap up soon before everybody loses patience and dignity here. Yeah.
The child of that birth.
Yeah.
There's an affair, and there's a child from the affair.
Yeah.
That child is their mamzer.
No.
It depends on the circumstance.
She's married. The child is the child of the affair, not the husband.
Yeah, correct, yeah.
The other one was.
Which makes the child the mamzer then.
Right.
How would that then factor?
No, actually, now that you mention it, you are ringing some bells. You're right. There's a long discussion that he has in that section. Again, when I first saw this source, this is about 9 pages long. When I reviewed for today, I looked at the convenient little snippet that I put. But you're right, he does dedicate a number of paragraphs to discuss the making this child a mumsen and actually saving him or her from that position. You're right. Next source, there was a question. I don't know why this case has kept coming up. We're going to go through this quickly. A young woman who lived a life in college of a little bit of freedom, got pregnant, had an abortion, 2 years later finishes college, decides to find a path back to God, goes through a number of curve organizations, finds a religious, pious streak in life, settles down, marries, through a shidduch system, has a beautiful marriage, a wonderful life, they observe Shabbos and Kashrus, they're living the dream. She gets pregnant, also a blessing, beautiful. It's a boy, it's a natural birth, it's her first child, and the husband says, oh, I'm so excited. Not only have we been blessed with pregnancy and a baby, we get to do a pigeon in her bed, and how rare is that? And she's thinking, ooh. Ooh, this is going to be difficult because he's not going to get to have his pigeon aben that he's wanted, and I'm going to have to tell him about what happened back in those days, which he doesn't know about because I put that all behind me. So what's at stake here? What if we say just do the pigeon aben, what prohibition has been violated? Bracha levatala. There's a bracha at the pigeon aben.
The aben is not a real coin. The coin is only a sefer. Well, our kohanim are really sfeke coin, except sefer.
Okay, so we can say that the kohanim are making brachas. We don't really know that kohanim anyway, so the whole thing is a sefer. Let's assume you found one of these kohanim yuchasim that have their long lineage, they're coming along, they're making the bracha. Bracha levatala. Does she have to end her marriage to avoid a bracha levatala? It sounds crazy, right? So I see a number of you saying, of course not. So luckily, the Rav Avadia Yosef in that long piece comes to the same position where he says there's a debate about the prohibition of bracha levatala. Let me ask you a question. What's wrong with a bracha levatala? A bracha that is in vain, so to speak. You're saying God's name. In what context are you saying God's name? You're saying, blessed are you, God, Lord of the universe, who did one thing or another. Does that sound like a bad thing to say?
No, but he doesn't know that it's Levatala, the Kohen making the bracha.
That's true, but it happens to be, because this is just a show, right? This is not real pidyon aben. There's no obligation for the pidyon aben, so it's a show. So we would be letting him do this unintentionally. So the question is, firstly, is this a biblical prohibition? It turns out that actually bracha levatala, for most views, is a rabbinic prohibition. Biblically speaking, you're praising God. You're saying praise. We try to tone that down so we don't treat God's name lightly. But in this circumstance, it's a rabbinic prohibition. This is the same case I mentioned last time we don't have on the sheet. Rabbi forgets to count the Omer one night, and then every night for 47 nights has to stand in shul saying, somebody else say the bracha, I forgot it a while ago. Oh, you're the rabbi, very nice. So actually, rabbis, the view has been taken. If you forget a night and you're in shul, you can say the bracha, even though it's... Well, yeah, you got to get some perks, right? So that's the view.
Yeah.
Whoever's saying it from the front, let's say, you're right, let's say you're the Shliach Tzibur, you're standing at the front, and then suddenly you realize, I'm in Avela, so I'm standing at the Amud, I forgot to say the Om a few nights ago, the rabbi's out, I'm going to have to say the bracha, I'm going to have to turn around and tell them I forgot it. So the assumption is you should say the bracha if you're going to feel embarrassed. If you're quite comfortable to say I forgot it, you know, this isn't the worst thing I've done, so that's fine. Page 7, we're going to wrap up now. I've been saying that for 10 minutes. Page 7, but this is the last page, so we are going to wrap up. The top source is from Rabbi Soloveitchik, and this was published in a volume called Divrei Hashkafa. I'm not sure if this was it was not published by him. I don't know who wrote this up, who translated it, if this was inscribed from Shiurim. There was a number of Hebrew volumes put out with his writings, and this is a point he makes here, and this is where he raises the issue of mincha. He says this is such an amorphous issue, and in an age, and he's writing this in the 60s, 70s, an age of total freedom, where what I want to do is the measure of what I should do. And in an age like that, when you say, if my dignity is impinged, rabbinic law goes out the window, you've just cast out about 70% of Jewish life for the sake of your dignity. I'm in the middle of a meeting, I don't want to go do mincha, it would embarrass me. I'm standing here with my colleagues, I'm trying to form a relationship and network and show them I'm reliable and that I'm one of them and they can trust me. And now in the middle of a conversation about their holidaying practices, I have to go and say, I just need to go and bow to the monotheistic lord of the universe. Okay, I'll talk to someone else about our deal. So, at what point do you draw the line? Do you say, this is an impingement on my dignity? Mincha, is mincha biblical or rabbinic obligation?
Rabbinic.
Right. The general policy is, the strictest view, is that you have to daven biblically once a day. Once a day, the Rambam says. Maimonides says once a day. And what does it mean, daven once a day? Not even Shmona Esrei. It means you turn to Kodesh Baruch and you say, Kodesh Baruch Hu, thank you. I need your help in my life. Thank you for giving me breath this morning. Done. Shachris has to take 50 minutes. Either way, right, rabbinic institutions have evolved over time to give us formulation, to give us articulation, to give us structure in life. And again, me even raising this would have put, I mean, it's on recording now, but it puts the system at stake. Because now I say, oh, hold on a minute, I don't even have to go to Minyan, I don't have to David Shachris, and my dignity, I'll just turn around, I'll wake up in the morning, I'll say, Moda ani lefanecha, and I'm done. And biblically speaking, that may be true. In fact, as you say, Nachmanides the Ramban says, you don't even have to daven once a day. The obligation biblically to daven is when you're in a situation of eis tzara, which means a traumatic instance. Rabbi Soloveitchik put them together by saying Maimonides thinks we're always in existential despair. So we always have an obligation to pray. So he solved that issue neatly, put them together. But he's saying we shouldn't treat this like, we have to be very careful, because what do we call dignity? And in the very last line he says, all right, three lines up from the bottom, last words. Kavod habrios. What is human dignity? Eino bibichinat kniya ledat popularit. This is not us making a concession to the popular view of how we should live. What's human dignity? Or what everybody else thinks. How people feel that I shouldn't have to walk away. Ki ima karab archoa elyon shebechirat sira. What is dignity? It's because of you. How do we even call dignity? Kavod habrios means the respect of, what's a bria? Creature. The very term for dignity is showing that we're dependent on a creator. Our dignity is all drawn from the fact that we come from God, and it shouldn't be just whims of, or the fades. It should be about how God feels. Now, in the next source, which we'll finish with, is Rav Lichtenstein. And Rav Lichtenstein makes a sociological point, a psychological point, and ends with a hopeful point on this matter, or at least a point that should charge us. He says he's had many conversations with many poskim who say, I never ever matter something. I never permit anything that anybody asks me because of Kavod Habrios. Despite everything we've said for the last two sessions, that there is huge freedom to use Kavod Habrios as a way to say, because of human dignity, I don't have to do this and I don't have to do that. Rabbis have said, we never ever use this. We never ever say this. And someone says to me, can I do this? I never say, oh, because of Kavod Habrios, you can do that. Why? Why don't they use it? The slippery slope argument, the position that the Rabbi Soloveitchik just laid out, meaning if I told people, oh, Kavod Habrios, you don't have to do that, we're never going to get anyone come to Minyan, I'm lying in bed. Oh, I feel undignified getting up at this time. Right? Meaning, it's just, it's an open book. Say whatever you like. It's free for all and everything falls apart. So he said that he had a conversation with Rabbi Soloveitchik. When Rabbi Soloveitchik said to him, he wrote this publicly in an article. This is in the fourth paragraph. B'midah mesuyemet, in a certain sense, and then he just, all right, I'll lay out what he says piece by piece. He says, people never use covered habrios as a justification to perform halakhic leniencies, but he says, we have to be honest, there are repercussions to this decision. There are consequences to rabbis not using covered habrios. Number one, it makes it look like we don't care about dignity. If you don't publicly endorse the fact that covered habrios has weight, it makes it look like we don't care about covered habrios. There is a sociological fallout to us ignoring that category in which it comes off that Jews don't care about dignity. They never employ that as a way out. Dignity doesn't matter, despite the fact that we said dignity is an enshrined Jewish value. Rabbis never use this. So obviously it's not. So that's number one. The fallout sociologically is it looks like we don't care about dignity. We don't train our kids to have dignity. We don't train our yeshiva bachrim and our seminary students to care about dignity because it doesn't feature in the halakhic system, number one. Number two, it corrupts the system. If you're not employing a legal, a legitimate outlet, you're corrupting the system. You're paskening to be machmir in cases when you shouldn't be. Those are the two fallouts. So for the second one, he says, we don't have to worry. Because all the rabbis who don't use it say they always give the right psak. They just clothe it in other things. And he said, Rabbi Soloveitchik said to him, he was asked a number of times a question in which he was makel, he was lenient, and the real reason was covered habrios, but he couched it in other things. He never said covered habrios, he used other reasons and kind of sophistry to cover it up, because we don't want to publicly use this. So he said, you don't have to worry about corrupting the system, because rabbis are still giving the right psak, they're just not giving the real reason. But that first thing is still now being promoted, that we don't care about dignity. It looks that way. It's a problem. And this is his finishing piece. This is page 7, bottom paragraph, Rav Lichtenstein. Even if from a practical point of view, that we do not use the end of that general principle, which is there was this mantra, Gadol kavod habrios, dignity is great, that it even pushes aside a negative precept of the Torah, which we said means rabbinic law. That's how it's been interpreted. So great is human dignity. It overrides rabbinic law. He says, even if we are reluctant to employ that last part of the statement, that it overrides rabbinic law, at the very least, it is incumbent upon us to make sure not to let the beginning of that mantra perish. What's the beginning of the mantra? Gadol kavod habrios. Dignity is great. And when we don't employ it judicially, we just throw the baby out with the bathwater. And even if we're reluctant to use this halachically, the first half of the statement we need to employ, Oto klal yesod ha-koveh ki gadol kavod habrios, kasheh anenu nitzavim bifnei isa lo taseh, when we're not going up against the lo taseh, v'lo shabbatazeh v'lo b'kumvaseh, neither passive or active, ela kola omed molenu hu'achoshesh lezilzul b'kvodo shal hazulat, in times when we're not in a case of conflict, dealing with an obligation or a prohibition or an exemption, but we're just dealing with the respect and dignity of another human being. We have the obligation, spiritually, philosophically, ethically, we have to emphasize, for example, that's why I brought in the case of the Hippocratic Oath and dealing with Chumras, because if we say, oh, covered habrios doesn't play a halachic role, he says at the very least, if we're not going to employ that judicially, in a vacuum, when it's the only thing that's at stake, the dignity of another, we have to make extra efforts to make sure we focus on that. Hatzorech behafnamat ha'arech, the need to internalize the value, shel kavod habrios omed bifneinu, stands before us, va'asur lanu lehitna'er amenu, and it is forbidden for us to hide from it. So what can we conclude? Oh my gosh, it is so late. I am so sorry. What can we conclude from this? When dignity and halacha clash, there is a decision sheet for us to follow. And the basic premise is, if you've got... questions, practical, come to me. Human dignity is a massive, vital, central value in Jewish thought and Jewish life. When it comes into conflict, it's pretty complicated. There are cases when it does go out the window. Biblical prohibitions are being actively, intentionally violated. It seems that dignity does fall away. The cases that comes up is rare. The most extreme cases we saw of biblical violation, there were actually an out. The one case I didn't mention was there's a biblical obligation if you owe someone money to pay them back. And the case we had, we didn't read at the top of the page, if there are orphans who inherit from their parents, they don't have anything left, they've got just the clothes on their back. And the expression in the Gemara is, if you owe someone money, you have to pay them back even the clothes on your back. The Gemara says, well, if that's all you've got, and it would lead to an indignity, covered habrios, you don't have to fulfill that biblical obligation. That biblical obligation, you can be passive in the face of it and not do it. But again, it needs to be either passive or unintentional, otherwise you're in trouble. Rabbinic law, again, is swept aside by human dignity, but we are very reluctant to employ that as a principle because it does open a can of worms where everything falls apart. And so the bottom line is, even if we are reluctant to use this halachically, which we may not be, you should ask questions, but the value itself, we have to make extra efforts to promote it, to cultivate it, to nurture it, to spread that this is a prime Jewish value. Human dignity is central to who we are, what we care about, and how the world that we want to shape and see. I'll leave it there. I wish you all a wonderful evening.